This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, a new effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally. To find out more, go to tryzonanow.com or call toll-free 1-866-669-9662. Be sure to mention Dr. Hoffman and you'll get a $50 savings and free shipping. That's 1-866-669-9662. Or tryzonanow.com.
Welcome to another edition of Layla Weighs In on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Thank you for joining me today. I'm Layla Mutin. I'm the nutritionist. I'm a registered dietitian nutritionist. The credential is moving from RD to RDN, so I'm trying to incorporate it in my own life. Registered dietitian nutritionist here at the Hoffman Center. I've been working with Dr. Hoffman since 2005, and this is my weekly podcast. I want to thank you for joining me, and I welcome your questions, comments, ideas for topics of discussion on this podcast. Please email me to radioprogram@AOL.com. That's radioprogram@AOL.com. Now, I've got a question here. I want to answer your questions today. I've got a question here from a fellow RDN, a colleague of mine, Kristen. And she writes, I have run across many clients with low triglycerides and elevated blood sugars, some of which are overweight and underweight. The common denominator with these clients is that they are compliant with the low-carb diet. I realize there are many factors that can contribute to elevated blood sugars, including stress, history of high blood sugar, insulin resistance, hormone imbalance. Can you share your experience with this and offer some guidance? Yes, as a matter of fact, I have seen in some of my clients as well. First of all, anyone on a low-carb diet, the way I kind of know that they're being compliant is what happens to their triglyceride level. Okay. So, but you first want a baseline triglyceride level. When they first come in to see you, you want a lipid profile. You want to see, you know, if their triglycerides, for instance, are high, say 250s or something like that, once they embark on a low-carb diet, what happens is those triglycerides fall off a cliff. And I've seen this happen in as little as 2 months. And really, the time to recheck lipid levels or the lipid profile after embarking on a low-carb diet is not sooner than 3 months or so. But I've seen it in as little as 8 weeks, you know, 2 months, that triglycerides fall off a cliff. That particular patient with a baseline triglyceride level of, say, 250, they now fall down to 100 or even less, maybe even under 80. Now, it's important to get that baseline level, because what if a client's baseline level is in the 400s, 500s, 600s? Once they embark on a low-carb diet, their triglycerides may fall to 200, 150. But if you don't have that baseline, and then you randomly look at their triglycerides after they've been on a low-carb diet for a while, and you see that it's at 200 or so, you may not think they're compliant when indeed they have been. Now, this person, anyone with triglycerides in the 400s, 500s, these are the exceptions. You don't see that too often, but it is related to high blood sugar. Now, so the way I kind of know that a client, a patient, has been compliant with a low-carb diet is their triglycerides literally fall off a cliff. That 200, 250 level triglyceride falls down to under 100. And it's a wonderful thing to see because, in my opinion, not enough doctors are paying attention to triglycerides. They're only still paying attention to cholesterol. So, but triglycerides are an independent risk factor for heart disease, as we know. So what about these people who are compliant with a low-carb diet, but they still have elevated blood sugar? The first thing I would do is, some of these things for you, Kristen, will be obvious, but I'm speaking to the rest of the audience here too. Blood sugar can be elevated with increasing age. If the client is, say, over 60, once we start getting into our 60s, 70s, 80s, blood sugar does naturally elevate, even with perfect compliance on a low-carb diet. And this may simply be a function of advancing age. So you have to decide whether to leave that alone or not. Certainly, for example, if I have a client in their 80s and she has a hemoglobin A1C of a 5.9 to a 6.1, and I know she's eating the right way, she's doing all the right things, she's exercising, I'm kind of going to leave that alone, and I'm going to say, you know, she's 82. Now, having said that, I'd want to do a review of the medication, because medications like steroids, I think even some blood pressure medications, if somebody's been on prednisone or are taking an inhaler or taking something like Singulair for asthma, for allergies, this can increase blood sugar levels. And as you say, stress, infection, all of those things, if they've had a recent surgery, this can also increase blood sugar levels. But in younger people, especially women, oral contraceptives, birth control pills will definitely increase blood sugar levels. I've seen young women with, you know, fasting blood sugars of 98, 102, when they're of normal weight, everything else appears to be fine, but it's that birth control pill that can cause some glucose intolerance, some carbohydrate intolerance. The other thing I would check is to see what their insulin levels are. If their blood sugars continue to stay elevated, what is the pancreas doing? Is it secreting enough insulin? A fasting insulin may be a good check. A proxy to that would be taking a blood, a serum C-peptide level. Another blood test we used to do often, but we do less often now, is fructosamine. Fructosamine is kind of a little bit of a proxy to insulin, but I think C-peptide is better. And I know that Dr. Hoffman would agree, and he would often do a C-peptide test when we're wondering, you know, with somebody of a normal weight, they're doing the diet well, that the blood sugar remains elevated, we wonder, what is the state of the pancreas? What is the health of the pancreas? But you know, the gold standard in really determining what the pancreas, how much insulin is being secreted by the pancreas, is that 4 to 5 hour glucose tolerance test, that oral glucose challenge. Because elevated blood sugars and not enough insulin is a reason for blood sugars to stay elevated. And it could be that this person may be a late-stage diabetic where we didn't know that they were a late-stage diabetic. And now the blood sugar is coming back elevated because the pancreas, after a lifetime of supporting a high-carb diet, is pretty much pooped. And it's not secreting as much insulin anymore. The beta cells in the islets of Langerhans in the pancreas are not doing their job. So that could definitely be a reason. But really, I think the gold standard would be to do another GTT to see what's going on. And finally, those who are compliant with a low-carb diet, it seems there are many definitions of a low-carb diet out there. Kristen, I know you're a practitioner and you already know this. I'm speaking to everyone else who may be listening. A definition of a real low-carb diet is a low-carb diet means not more than about 40 grams of carbohydrates a day. For most people, you have to eat less than 40 grams of carbs a day to begin the metabolic shift to lipolysis ketosis. Now, when you do an Atkins diet, phase one begins with 20 grams of carbs a day or less. It kind of floats between 16, 17 grams and 20 grams a day. That will really hypershift your metabolism into lipolysis ketosis. Now, you know, in other scientific research, I've seen low-carb diet defined as, you know, 90 grams of carbs a day or 120 grams of carbs a day, because we know that the threshold for metabolism to really shift into a full-blown shift into a glucose-burning metabolism requires 130 grams of carbohydrates a day. So in the scientific research arena, a low-carb diet may be called any diet where the carb intake is less than the required dose of 130 grams of carbs a day. So this is also something we need to take into consideration. And a general low-carb diet can be as much as 80 grams of carbs daily, because even when you do something like Atkins, which is in four phases, phase one being 20 grams or less, and then as weight loss continues to occur, you can creep up on the carb load a little bit in, you know, 2, maybe 3 gram increments or 5 gram increments. Some people are able to maintain steady weight loss on 30 grams of carbs, 35, even 40 grams of carbs. Some even 50 grams of carbs, they're still able to hit their critical carbohydrate level for losing, the CCLL, critical carbohydrate level for losing. And then once weight loss, the goal has been reached, they can shift it 50 grams or even higher just for maintenance. So a lot of things to look at here. Those elevated blood sugars, age may be an issue, medications may be an issue, a recent trauma or a stress, an infection, a common cold will raise blood sugar. Anyone who's had a flu or fever, that can also raise blood sugar. Steroids, oral contraceptives, even those on HRT, another mention, because I mentioned oral contraceptives before. HRT, you know, hormone replacement therapy, any kind of HRT can raise blood sugar to some degree. Not a whole lot, but it depends. It can actually raise blood sugar. Yeah, those are the things that I would look at for those on a low-carb diet. The other thing is, a lot of low-carb dieters are relying on low-carb diet products. Many of them are sweetened with stevia or Truvia, the brand of stevia, sugar alcohols like erythritol, mannitol, sorbitol, xylitol, all of those. While we know that the sugar alcohols are not recognized as carbs in the body and kind of float on through, for some people it does impact blood sugar. So this may be playing into the higher blood sugars. I definitely know those low-carb dieters who insist on having their diet soda or their Crystal Light or something with an artificial sweetener in it, especially NutraSweet or aspartame, but even Splenda. These people will find that their weight loss will slow down, they will go into a plateau, and that blood sugars may remain elevated. So these are the various reasons I can think of to see, you know, to determine what's keeping blood sugar elevated, besides a thorough look at the diet. Kristen has another question. She says, I've heard you mention on several podcasts that you recommend methylselinocysteine. We're talking about selenium supplements now. That you recommend methylselinocysteine as opposed to selenomethionine, which is a product we used to use here at the Hoffman Center, selenomethionine. Kristen continues, I gather this has something to do with the conversion to methionine, which is not desirable. You're correct. Can you elaborate, as I want to share this with my medical director? I pulled this right off the Life Extension website, Kristen. For anybody who looks at the Life Extension website, there's a lot of useful scientific information. They include their references. So if you're looking for references, you can pull it off of there. But I'm going to quote here about the methyl selenocysteine. Let me give a little background to selenium first. We know that selenium is an important antioxidant. It's an essential cofactor of glutathione peroxidase. And selenium is incorporated into proteins to make selenoproteins, which are important antioxidant enzymes. Now, the antioxidant properties of selenoproteins help to block cellular damage from free radicals. This is why selenium is such an important antioxidant. High doses of vitamin C can enhance the absorption of selenium, which is helpful. And the mineral selenium is best taken along with other antioxidant supplements like vitamin E. So methyl L-selenocysteine is a naturally occurring seleno amino acid that is synthesized by plants like garlic and broccoli. And methyl L-selenocysteine is an organoselenium compound and also more bioabsorbable than other forms. This is what some of the scientists have shown us. This is also from Life Extension, lif.org, Life Extension website. And here's the important point, Kristen. Unlike selenomethionine, which is incorporated into proteins in place of methionine, methyl selenocysteine, is not incorporated into any proteins so that it is fully available for the synthesis of selenium-containing enzymes such as glutathione. So basically, it's more bioavailable than regular old selenomethionine, which is the reason for the switch. And now, interestingly, speaking of selenium, there was a study in the October 2016 International Journal of Cancer entitled Paternal Selenium Deficiency but not supplementation during preconception alters mammary gland development in female rat offspring. This was a rat study. We know that breast cancer is a global public epidemic, and recent studies have shown that paternal nutrition can influence offspring health, including breast cancer risk. And selenium is a micronutrient with an essential role in central aspects of embryogenesis, male fertility, cancer, and that it's been extensively studied as a chemopreventive agent in several breast cancer experimental models. So they designed an animal study to evaluate whether the father's selenium deficiency or supplementation during preconception could affect the female offspring mammary gland development, breast development, and breast cancer susceptibility. Well, what they found was that paternal selenium deficiency changed the mammary glandular tissue in the female offspring enough that conferred higher susceptibility to certain mammary gland tumors. However, paternal selenium supplementation did not influence any of these parameters. So very interesting study on selenium. And finally, Kristen has a final question, and I'm sure Dr. Hoffman and I will talk about this too. She says, there seems to be an increase in mucus for patients with leaky gut. I understand this has to do with mucosal barriers, immune function. Can you elaborate on this in terms of our mucosal linings and how leaky gut affects this? Now, the reason for more mucus secretion is that with a leaky gut, the barrier, the epithelium, is still trying to defend itself or is reacting in very much the same way. When we have a cold virus or allergy, we have more congestion in our sinuses or in our lungs. There is more phlegm. There is more mucus. It's really the same kind of thing that's going on there. the mucus there is part of the inflammation, and that inflammation is occurring in an effort for the body to rid itself of the thing that it's trying to rid itself of. And that often is occurring with a leaky gut. But I'm sure we're going to elaborate this further on more podcasts, as leaky gut is often a major topic. Okay. So I want to thank you, Kristen, thank you for your questions. And I invite any of you listening to contact me via radioprogram@AOL.com with any questions or comments or topics related to health, wellness, and nutrition that you may be interested in hearing about. Thank you for joining me on another edition of Layla Weighs In on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. This is Layla Mutin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.